It burned her lips and scalded her tongue and set fire to her esophagus. But when Donovan asked, "How is it?" she managed to smile and said, "Fine." She smacked her lips as if she'd never tasted anything so delicious, while vowing to pour it down the drain as soon as she could find a restroom. Annette was right. Jeff was at least as cute as his older brother, had the same dark eyes and long, unruly hair, though Donovan had tidied up a bit for his jury. Jeff wore a coat and tie, but also jeans and boots. He was not a lawyer. Indeed, according to Annette, he had flunked out of college. But according to Maddie, he worked closely with Donovan and did a lot of his dirty work. Vic had spent 4 hours on the witness stand the day before, and he was still amused by his arguments with Strayhorn Cole's lawyers. One story led to another. Maddie asked Jeff, "What's your take on the jury?" "They're all in," he said without hesitation. "Maybe with one exception, but we're in good shape." Donovan said, "They offered $500,000 to settle this afternoon after the last witness. We got him on the run." Vic said, "Take the money, you idiot." Donovan asked, "Maddie, what would you do?" "Well, $500,000 is not much for two dead boys, but it's a lot for Hopper County. No one on that jury has ever seen such a sum, and they'll have a hard time handing it over to one of their own." "Take it or roll the dice?" Donovan asked. "Take it." "Jeff?" "Take the money." "Samantha?" Samantha was breathing through her mouth, trying to extinguish the flames. She licked her lips and said, "Well, 2 weeks ago I couldn't spell lawsuit. Now you want my advice on whether or not to settle one?" "Yes, you have to vote, or we'll cut off the booze." "Please do. I'm just a lowly legal aid lawyer, so I'd take the money and run." Donovan took a small sip, smiled, and said, "Four against one. I love it." Only one vote counted, and it was clear the case would not be settled. Maddie asked, "What about your closing argument? Can we hear it?" "Of course," he said, jumping to his feet, straightening his tie, and placing his tumbler on a shelf. Along one side of the long table, he began to pace, staring at his audience like a veteran stage actor. Maddie whispered to Samantha, "He likes to practice on us when we have the time." He stopped, looked directly at Samantha, and began. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, a pile of money will not bring back Eddie and Brandon Tate. They've been dead now for 19 months, their lives crushed out of them by the men who work for Strayhorn Cole. But money is all we have to measure damages in cases like this. Cold, hard cash. That's what the law says. It's now up to you to decide how much. So let's start with Brandon, the younger of the two, a frail little boy, only 8 years old and born 2 months premature. He could read by the time he was four and loved his computer, which, by the way, was under his bed when the 6-ton boulder arrived. The computer, too, was found mangled and without power, as dead as Brandon. He was smooth without being showy, sincere without a hint of anything but sincerity. He had no notes and didn't need them. Samantha was immediately captivated and would have given him any sum of money he asked for. He was pacing back and forth, very much on stage and fully in command of his script. At one point, though, Maddie startled them with, "Objection, you can't say that." Donovan laughed and said, "My apologies, Your Honor. I'll ask the jurors to disregard what I just said, which, of course, is impossible, and that's why I said it in the first place." "Objection," Maddie said again. There were no wasted words, no hyperbole, no flowery quotations from the Bible or Shakespeare, no false emotions, Nothing but a carefully nuanced argument in favor of his client and against an awful company, all delivered effortlessly, spontaneously. He suggested the amount of $1 million per child and $1 million in punitive damages. $3 million total. A large sum to him, and certainly to the jurors, but a drop in the bucket for Strayhorn Cole. Last year, the company's gross income was $14 million a week. When he finished, that particular jury was already in his pocket. The real one would not be as easy. As Vic poured more whiskey, Donovan challenged them to pick apart his closing argument. He said he would be up all night revising it. He claimed the whiskey loosened his creative thoughts, and some of his best final summations were the result of a few hours of thoughtful sipping. Maddie argued that $3 million was too much. It might work in larger cities, but not in Hopper County, or Nolan County for that matter. She reminded him that neither county had ever seen a $1 million verdict, and he reminded her that there was a first time for everything. And no one could create a better set of facts. Facts he had just clearly and masterfully laid out before the jury. Back and forth, back and forth. Samantha excused herself and went to the restroom. She poured the whiskey down the drain and hoped she never encountered it again. She said goodnight, wished Donovan all the luck in the world, and drove to the Starlight Motel, where the Booker family was enjoying an extended stay. She had cookies for the kids and two romance novels for Pamela. While Mandy and Trevor toyed with their homework, the women eased outside, where they leaned on the hood of Samantha's Ford and talked business. Pamela was excited because a friend had found a small apartment in Colton, just $400 a month. The kids were falling behind in school, and after three nights at the motel, she was ready to move on. They decided to leave early on the next morning, take the kids to school, and look at the apartment. Samantha would do the driving. Chapter 20. After 2 weeks in Brady, or more accurately, 3 weeks away from Scully and Pershing, Samantha's sleep deprivation had been thoroughly exercised, and she was back to her old habits. At 5 o'clock on Friday morning, she was sipping coffee in bed and hammering out a 3-page memo on the subject of Buddy Reiser's black lungs and Casper Slate's fraudulent behavior in screwing him out of benefits. At 6 o'clock, she emailed it to Maddie, Donovan, and her father. Marshall Kofer's reaction was something she was eager to hear. Another big lawsuit was the last thing on Donovan's mind, and her intent was not to pester him on this momentous day. She was simply hoping he might find the time over the weekend to read about Mr. Reiser and pass along his thoughts. 10 minutes later, she received his thoughts. His email read, "I have battled with these slime balls tooth and nail for the past 12 years, and I hate them with a passion. My fantasy trial is a huge courtroom showdown against Castrate, a grand expose of all their sins. I love this case. Let's talk later. Off to war in Colton. Should be fun." She replied, "Will do. Best of luck." At 7 o'clock, she drove to the Starlight Motel and gathered up the Bookers. Mandy and Trevor were dressed in their best and eager to get back to school. As Samantha drove, they ate her donuts and chattered nonstop. Again, the line between lawyering and social work was getting blurred, but it didn't matter. According to Maddie, in addition to providing legal advice, the job often included marriage counseling, carpooling, cooking, job searching, tutoring, financial advising, apartment hunting, and babysitting. She was fond of saying, "We don't work by the hour, but by the client." Outside the school in Colton, Samantha stayed in the car while Pamela went inside with her children. She wanted to say hello to the teachers and explain things. Samantha had sent daily emails to the school, and the teachers and principal had been supportive. With the kids securely in place back where they belonged, Samantha and Pamela spent the next 2 hours looking into the rather sparse selection of rental housing in and around Colton. The apartment Pamela's friend had gushed on about was only a few blocks from the school and one of 4 units in a run-down commercial building that had been partially converted. The place was clean enough, with a few sticks of furniture, which was important because Pamela had none. It was priced at $400 a month, which seemed reasonable given its condition. As they left, Pamela said, with no enthusiasm at all, "I guess we could live there." Maddie's slush fund was good for a couple of months only, though Samantha did not divulge this. She gave the accurate impression that money was tight and that Pamela needed to find work as soon as possible. No hearing on the garnishment order had been set. In fact, Samantha had not heard a word from the defendant, Top Market Solutions. She had called the lamp factory twice to make sure Mr. Simmons was in a semi-pleasant mood and that Pamela could still get her job back as soon as the garnishment went away. Prospects for other employment in Hopper County were dim. Samantha had never seen the inside of a mobile home, had never really thought about doing so, but 2 miles east of the city limits, at the end of a gravel road, she had her first experience. It was a nice trailer, furnished and clean, and only $550 a month. Pamela confessed that she had grown up in a trailer, like so many of her friends, and was fond of the privacy. To Samantha, the place at first seemed incredibly cramped, but as she walked around it, she had to confess she'd seen much tighter quarters in Manhattan. There was a duplex on a hill above the town. Nice views and all, but the folks next door gave all appearances of being insufferable. There was a vacant house in a shady part of town. They looked at it from the street and did not get out of the car. From there, the search fizzled, and they decided to have coffee downtown, not far from the courthouse. Samantha resisted the temptation to walk over, sneak into the back row, and watch Donovan perform for the jury. A couple of locals in a booth nearby talked of nothing but the trial. One said he had gone by at 8:30, and the courtroom was already packed. In his windy opinion, it was the biggest trial ever in Colton. "What's it about?" Samantha asked pleasantly. "You don't know about the Tate trial?" the man asked incredulously. "Sorry, not from around here." "Oh, boy." He shook his head and sort of waved her off. His pancakes arrived, and he lost interest in holding court. He knew far too much to share in such a short time. Pamela had a friend in Colton she needed to check on. Samantha left her at the cafe and drove back to Brady. As soon as she walked into her office, Maddie was right behind her with, "Just got a text from Jeff. Donovan wouldn't settle, and the jury has the case. Let's grab a sandwich, eat in the car, and drive over." "I just left there," Samantha said. "Besides, you can't get a seat." "And how do you know this?"
"I have sources."
Instead, they ate sandwiches in the conference room with Claudel and waited nervously for the next text. When it did not arrive, they drifted back to their offices, puttering, still waiting. At 1 p.m., Mrs. Francine Crump arrived on schedule for the formal signing of her free will. It seemed odd that a woman who owned land worth at least $200,000 would pinch pennies so tightly, but the truth was that she had nothing but the land and the coal beneath it. Samantha had corresponded with the Mountain Trust, a well-established conservation group that specialized in taking title to land and preserving it. In Francine's simple will, she bequeathed her 80 acres to the Mountain Trust and to the exclusion of her 5 adult children. As Samantha read the will to her and explained everything carefully, Francine began crying. It was one thing to get mad and cut out the kids, but it was quite another when she saw the words on paper. Samantha began to worry about the signing. For the will to be valid, Francine had to be legally competent and certain of what she was doing. Instead, for the moment anyway, she was emotional and uncertain. At 80 and in declining health, she would not be around much longer. Her children would certainly contest the will. Since they would not be able to argue that the Mountain Trust unduly influenced their mother, they would be forced to attack the will on the grounds that she was mentally unfit when she signed it. Samantha would be smack in the middle of an ugly family brawl. For reinforcements, she summoned both Annette and Maddie. The two veterans had seen it before and spent a few minutes with Francine, chatting about this and that until the tears stopped. Annette asked about her children and grandchildren, but this did not brighten her mood. She said she rarely saw them. They had forgotten about her. The grandkids were growing up so fast and she was missing it all. Maddie explained that once she died, and once the family learned about the gift of the land to the Mountain Trust, there would be trouble. They would likely hire a lawyer and contest the will. Was that what she wanted? Francine held her ground. She was bitter at her neighbors for selling out to a coal company, and she was determined to protect her land. She didn't trust her children and knew they would grab the cash as quickly as possible. With her emotions in check, she signed the will, and the three lawyers witnessed it. They also signed affidavits attesting to their client's mental stability. After she left, Maddie said, "We'll see that one again." At 2 p.m., and with no word from the courtroom, Samantha informed Maddie that she needed to return to Colton to pick up the Bookers. Maddie jumped to her feet, and they left in a hurry. Donovan was killing time in a gazebo behind the hideous courthouse. He was sitting on a bench and chatting with Lisa Tate, the boy's mother and his plaintiff. Jeff was nearby on the phone, smoking a cigar and looking nervous. Donovan introduced Maddie and Samantha to Lisa and said nice things about the way she had held up during the 5-day trial. The jury was still deliberating, he said, as he pointed to a second-floor window in the courthouse. "That's their room," he said. "They've had the case about 3 hours. Maddie said, "I'm so sorry about your boys, Lisa. Such a senseless tragedy." "Thank you," she replied softly, but had no interest in pursuing the conversation. "So, how was your closing argument?" Samantha asked after an awkward pause. Donovan smiled the victor's smile and said, "Probably top three of all time. Had him in tears, didn't I, Lisa?" She nodded and said, "It was very emotional." Jeff finished his call and joined them. "What's taken so long?" he asked Donovan. "Relax. They had a nice lunch, courtesy of the county. Now they're walking through the evidence. I'd give them another hour." "Then what?" Maddie asked. "A big verdict," he said with another smile. "A record for Hopper County." Jeff said, "Strayhorn offered $900,000 when the jury retired. Perry Mason here said no." Donovan looked at his brother with a sneer, as if to say, "What do you know? Just hang on. I'll show you." Samantha was struck by the sheer recklessness of Donovan's decisions. His client was a poor woman with little education and dim prospects for a better life. Her husband was in prison for selling drugs. She and her two sons had been living in a small trailer deep in the hills when the tragedy happened. Now she was alone with nothing but a lawsuit. She could walk away right now with at least $500,000 in cash, more than she had ever dreamed of. Yet her lawyer said no and rolled the dice. Blinded by the dream of striking gold, he had laughed at the chance of getting a decent sum. What if the jury marched off in the wrong direction and said no? What if the coal company managed to silently exert pressure in places never to be known? Samantha could not imagine the horror of Lisa Tate walking out of the courtroom empty-handed, with nothing to show for the deaths of her little boys. Donovan, though, seemed unconcerned, even cocky. He certainly appeared calmer than anyone else in their little group. Her father had always said trial lawyers were a strange breed. They walked a fine line between big verdicts and catastrophic failures, and the great ones were not afraid of the risks. Maddie and Samantha couldn't hang around. The Bookers were waiting. They said goodbye, and Donovan invited them to stop by his office later to celebrate. Pamela Booker preferred the trailer. She had spoken to the owner and negotiated the rent down to $500 a month for 6 months. Maddie said the clinic could swing the first three, but after that, the rent was all hers. When they picked the kids up from school, Pamela told them about their new home, and they drove straight over to see it. The call came at 5:20, and the news was great. Donovan had his million-dollar verdict, $3 million to be exact, the amount he asked from the jury. $1 million for each child, $1 million in punitive damages. An unheard-of verdict for that part of the world. Jeff told Maddie the courtroom was still packed when the verdict was read, and the crowd applauded wildly before the judge calmed things down. Samantha was in the conference room with Maddie and Annette, and all three reveled in the verdict. They high-fived, fist-pumped, and chatted excitedly, as if their own little firm had done something great. It wasn't Donovan's first million-dollar verdict. He'd had one in West Virginia and one in Kentucky, both coal truck collisions. But it was his largest. They were happy, even giddy, and no one was really sure if they were more excited over winning or relieved at not losing. It didn't matter. So this is what litigation is all about, Samantha thought. Maybe she was beginning to understand. This was the rush, the high, the narcotic that pushed trial lawyers to the brink. This was the thrill that Donovan sought when he refused to settle for cash on the table. This was the overdose of testosterone that inspired men like her father to dash around the world chasing cases. Maddie declared that they would throw a party. She called Chester and snapped him into high gear. Burgers on the grill in their backyard, with champagne to start and beer to finish. 2 hours later, the party materialized perfectly in the cool evening. Donovan proved to be a graceful winner, deflecting congratulations and giving his client all the credit. Lisa was there, alone. In addition to the hosts and Samantha, the crowd included Annette with Kim and Adam, Barb and her husband, Wilt, Claudel and her husband, Vic Canzaro and his girlfriend, and Jeff. In a toast, Maddie said, "Victories are rare in our business, so let's savor this moment of triumph, good over evil and all that jazz, and wipe out these three bottles of champagne. Cheers!" Samantha was sitting in a wicker patio swing chatting with Kim when Jeff asked if she needed a top off. She did, and he took her empty glass. When he returned, he looked at the narrow, empty spot beside her, and she invited him to have a seat. It was very cozy. Kim got bored and left them. The air was cool, but the champagne kept them warm. Chapter 21. Her second adventure in the Cessna Skyhawk was not quite as thrilling as the first. They waited at the Nolan County airfield an hour for some weather to move on. Perhaps they should have waited longer. Donovan at one point mumbled something about postponing the trip. Jeff, also a pilot, seemed to agree, but then saw a break in the front and thought they could make it. After watching them study a weather screen at the terminal and fret over turbulence, Samantha was secretly hoping they would cancel. But they did not. They took off into the clouds, and for the first 10 minutes, she thought she might be sick. From the front, Donovan said, "Hang on," as the small plane was tossed about. Hang on to what, exactly? She was in the rear seat, which was cramped even for her. She had been relegated to second class and was already promising herself she would never do this again. Bullets of rain pecked vigorously at the windshield. At 6,000 feet, The clouds thinned considerably, and the ride became smooth. Up front, both pilots seemed to relax. All three on board had headsets, and Samantha, breathing normally, was fascinated by the radio. The Skyhawk was being handled by Washington Air Traffic Control, and there were at least four other aircraft on the same frequency. Everyone was terribly excited about the weather, with pilots calling in the latest updates based on what they had encountered. Her fascination, though, soon led to boredom as they hummed along, bouncing slightly on top of the clouds. She could see nothing below, and nothing on either side. An hour in, and she almost nodded off. 2 hours and 15 minutes after they left Brady, they landed at a small airport in Manassas, Virginia. They rented a car, found a drive-through for carry-out lunch tacos, and arrived at the Cofer Group's new digs in Alexandria at 1 p.m. Marshall greeted them warmly and apologized for the emptiness of the place. It was, after all, Saturday. Marshall was delighted to see his daughter, especially under the circumstances. She was hanging around with a real trial lawyer and seemed keenly interested in pursuing a promising lawsuit against corporate bad guys. After just 2 weeks in the coal fields, she was well on her way to a real conversion. He had been trying in vain for years to show her the light. After some small talk, Marshall said to Donovan, "Congrats on the verdict down there. Tough place to get one." Samantha had not mentioned the Tate verdict to her father. She had emailed him twice with details about the meeting, but nothing about the trial. Donovan said, "Thanks. There was a line or two in the Roanoke paper. I guess you saw it."
"Missed that," he said.
"We monitor a lot of trials through a national network. Your story popped up late last night, and I read the summary. A great set of facts." They were seated around a square table with real flowers in the center, next to coffee in a silver pot. Marshall had dressed down and was slumming in a cashmere sweater and slacks. The gray boys were in jeans and old sports coats. Samantha wore jeans and a sweater. Donovan said thanks again and answered Marshall's questions about the trial. Jeff said nothing and missed nothing. He and Samantha exchanged looks occasionally. She poured more coffee and finally said, "Perhaps we should move along?" "Right," Marshall said as he took a sip. "How much do I know?" "There's nothing new," Samantha said. "I've just started digging. And I'm sure we'll learn a lot more after I file the claim for black lung benefits." "Casper Slate has a nasty reputation," Marshall said.
"They've earned it," Donovan replied.
"I've fought them for a long time."
"Give me your lawsuit. Give me your theory."
Donovan took a deep breath and glanced at Samantha. He said, "Federal court, probably in Kentucky, maybe West Virginia. Certainly not Virginia because of the caps on damages. We file the lawsuit with one plaintiff, Buddy Reiser, and we sue Casper Slate and Lone Rock Coal. We allege fraud and conspiracy, perhaps racketeering, and we ask for the moon in punitive damages. It's a punitive case, plain and simple. Lone Rock Coal is currently capitalized at $6 billion and insured to the hilt. Casper Slate is private, and we don't know what it's worth, but we'll find out. As we dig, we hope we find other fraud cases. The more the better. But if we don't, we'll always be ready to take the Reiser case to the jury and ask for a fortune in punitives." Marshall nodded as if he agreed, as if he'd done this 100 times. Donovan paused and asked, "What's your take on it?"
"Agreed, so far.
It sounds good. Especially if the fraud really exists, and there's no way to explain it away. It certainly looks legitimate, and the jury appeal is fantastic. Actually, I think it's brilliant. A corrupt law firm full of high-priced lawyers hiding medical evidence to beat some poor, sick miner out of his meager benefits. Wow.
It's a trial lawyer's dream. It's a clear punitive case with tremendous upside potential. He paused, took a calculated sip, and continued. But first, of course, there is the little matter of the actual lawsuit. You practice alone, Donovan, with almost no staff and, shall we say, limited resources. A lawsuit like this will take 5 years and cost $2 million, minimum. $1 million, Donovan said. Split the difference, $1.5 million. I'm assuming that's still out of your reach. It is, but I have friends, Mr. Kofer. Let's go with Marshall, shall we? Sure, Marshall. There are 2 law firms in West Virginia, and 2 in Kentucky that I conspire with. We often pool our money and resources and divide the work. Still, I'm not sure we can risk that much. I suppose that's why we're here. Marshall shrugged and laughed and said, "That's my business, the litigation wars. I consult with lawyers and with litigation funders. I play matchmaker between the guys with the cash and the guys with the cases." "So you can arrange $1 or $2 million for the litigation expenses?" "Sure. That's no problem. Not in this line. Most of our work involves between $10 and $50 million. $2 million is easy." "And how much does it cost us, the lawyers?" "That depends on the fund. The great thing about this case is that it'll cost $2 million, let's say, and not $30 million. The less you take for expenses, the more you keep in fees. I'm assuming you'll get 50% of the recovery." "I've never asked for 50%. "Well, welcome to the big leagues, Donovan. In all major cases, the trial lawyers get 50% these days. And why not? You take all the risks, do all the work, and put up all the money. A big verdict is a windfall for a client like Buddy Reiser. Poor guy's trying to get $1,000 a month. Get him a few million and he's a happy dude, right?" "I'll think about it. I've never taken more than 40. "Well, it may be difficult to arrange funding if we're not at 50. That's just the way it is. So we line up the money. Now what about the manpower?" "Casper Slate will throw an army of lawyers at you. They're best and brightest, meanest and slickest. And if you think they cheat now, just wait until their own necks are on the line and they're trying to hide their dirty underwear. It'll be a war, Donovan. One like we seldom see. You ever sue a law firm?" "No, I was too busy suing airlines. Believe me, they were tough enough. What was your biggest verdict?" Samantha almost said, "Please, come on." The last thing they needed was Marshall Kofer on stage telling his war stories. Without the slightest hesitation, he gave that smug smile and said, "I popped Braniff for $40 million in San Juan, Puerto Rico in 1982. Took 7 weeks. She wanted to ask, "Great, Dad, and was that the fee you kept offshore and tried to bury until Mom got wind of it?" Marshall continued, "I was the lead lawyer, but there were 4 of us, and we worked our tails off. My point, Donovan, is that you will need some high-powered help. The fund will scrutinize you and your team before it commits the money." Donovan said, "I'm not worried about the team, or the preparation, or the trial. I've spent my career looking for a case like this. The lawyers I bring in are all veteran trial lawyers, and they know the terrain. This is our backyard. The jurors will be our people. The judge, we can only hope, will be beyond the reach of the defendants. And on appeal, the verdict will be in the hands of federal judges, not state judges elected by the coal companies." "I realize this," Marshall said. "You didn't answer the question," Jeff said, almost rudely. "How much do we give up in exchange for the funding?" Marshall shot him a hard look, then instinctively smiled and said, "Depends. It's negotiable. That's my job to arrange the deal, but just guessing, I'd say the fund I have in mind would ask for a 1/4 of the attorney's fees. As you know, it's impossible to predict what a jury might do, Therefore, it's impossible to project what the fees might be. If the jury gives you, say, 10 million, and the expenses are 2, then the expenses come off the top, and you split 8 with your client. He gets 4 million, you get the same. The fund gets a quarter of that. You get the rest. Not a great deal for the fund, but not a loser either. A 50% return. Needless to say here, fellas, but the bigger the verdict, the better. Personally, I think 10 million is low. I can see a jury getting highly agitated with Casper Slate and Lone Rock Cole and going for blood. He was quite convincing. And Samantha had to remind herself that he once extracted huge sums from juries. Who are these guys? Donovan asked. Investors, other funds, hedge funds, private equity guys, you name it. There's a surprising number of Asians who have discovered the game. They're petrified by our tort system, but also captivated by it. They think they're missing something. I have several retired lawyers who struck gold in their day. They know litigation and are not afraid of the risks. They've done quite well in this business. Donovan seemed unsure. I'm sorry, he said. This is all new to me. I've heard of litigation funds, but I've never been near one. Marshall said, it's just old-fashioned capitalism, but from our side of the street. Now, a plaintiff's lawyer with a great case, but no money, can take on corporate thugs anywhere and level the field. And they review the case and predict the outcome? That's my job, really. I consult with both sides, the trial lawyer and the fund. Based on what Samantha has told me and a review of the pertinent documents, and especially because of your growing reputation in the courtroom, I have no hesitation in recommending this case to one of my funds. It will approve $1 to $2 million in short order, and you're in business. Donovan looked at Jeff, who looked at Marshall, and asked, back in your prime, Mr. Kofer, would you take this case? In a heartbeat. Big law firms make lousy defendants, especially when you catch them red-handed. Donovan asked Samantha, do you think Buddy Reiser is up to the challenge? She replied, I have no idea. All he wants are his benefits, present and past. We haven't discussed a lawsuit like this. In fact, he doesn't even know all the stuff I found in his medical records. I was planning on meeting with him next week. What's your gut feeling? You want my gut feeling about something I know nothing about? Yes or no? Yes, he's a fighter. They walked down the street to a sports bar with 5 screens, all showing college football. Donovan was a Hokie from Virginia Tech, rabid as all of them, and was keen to find scores. They ordered beers and gathered around a table. After the waiter placed 4 tall mugs in front of them, Marshall said to Donovan, your name popped up online last night. I was looking at contamination cases in the coal fields. Sorry, but that's how I spend my reading time. And I came across the Peck Mountain Sludge Pond and the Hammer Valley Cancer Cluster. According to a story in the Charleston paper, you've been investigating the case for some time. Anything in the works? Donovan made eye contact with Samantha, who quickly shook her head. No, I haven't said a word. He said, we're still investigating and signing up clients. Clients means a lawsuit, right? Not prying here, just a bit curious. It sounds like a massive case, and a very expensive one. Kroll Mining is a monster. I know Kroll very well, Donovan said with caution. Not for a split second would he trust Marshall Kofer with any information he might swap or barter in another deal. When it was obvious he preferred not to talk about the case, Marshall said, oh, well, I know 2 funds that specialize in toxic waste cases. It's an extremely lucrative area, I might add. Is everything lucrative, Dad? Samantha wanted to ask. Then she thought,
What a perfect match. Donovan Gray and his gang, who either have possession of or access to a treasure trove of ill-gotten documents once owned by Kroll Mining, and the Kofra Group, a gang of disbarred lawyers who no doubt would bend the law again if put in a bind. That was just in one corner. In the other corner was Kroll Mining, a company with the worst safety record in the history of U.S. coal production, and an owner who is reputed to be one of the deadliest Russian gangsters in Putin's frat pack. And in the center of the ring, and dodging bullets, were the poor and suffering souls of Hammer Valley, who'd been cajoled out of their trailers and sweet-talked into signing up for this thrilling adventure into American tort law. They would be named as plaintiffs and sue for $1 billion. If they got 1,000, they'd spend it on cigarettes and lottery tickets. Wow. Samantha chugged her beer and once again vowed to avoid serious litigation. She watched football on two screens, but had no idea who was playing. Marshall was telling a story about two jets, one from Korea and one from India, that collided over the Hanoi airport in 1992. Everybody was dead, and nobody was from America. However, Marshall filed suit in Houston, where the juries understand big verdicts. This fascinated Donovan, and Jeff seemed mildly interested. That was enough of an audience for Marshall. Samantha kept watching the game. After one beer, Donovan was piloting, they walked back to the office and said goodbye. Samantha noticed that the sun was out and the sky was clear. Perhaps the ride home would be nice and smooth, with great visibility. She pecked her father on the cheek and promised to call later. Chapter 22. The Tate verdict brought excitement to the area and was a source of endless gossip and speculation. According to a story in the Roanoke paper, Strayhorn Coal was promising a vigorous appeal. Its lawyers had little to say, but others were not so timid. A vice president of the company called the verdict shocking. A mouthpiece for some economic development group worried that such a huge verdict might harm the state's reputation as a place favorable to business. One of the jurors, unnamed, was quoted and said there had been a lot of tears in the jury room. Lisa Tate was unavailable for comment, but her lawyer was not. Samantha watched and listened and had late-night drinks with Donovan and Jeff. Diet soda for her, Dickel for them. Strayhorn might have been posturing when it promised an appeal, but Donovan said the company really wanted to settle. With two dead kids at issue, the company knew it would be difficult to ever win. The punitive damages would be automatically reduced from $1 million to $350,000, so roughly a quarter of the verdict was already gone. The company offered $1.5 million to settle on the Tuesday after the verdict, and Lisa Tate wanted to take it. Donovan let it slip that he was getting 40%, so he could smell a nice payday. On Wednesday, he, Jeff, and Samantha met with Buddy and Mavis Reiser to discuss the potential lawsuit against Lone Rock Coal and Casper Slate. The Reisers were devastated to learn that the law firm had known for years that Buddy was suffering from black lung, yet hid the evidence. Buddy angrily said, "Sue the bastards for everything," and never, during the two-hour meeting, backed down. The couple left Donovan's office mad and determined to fight until it was over. That night, again over drinks, Donovan confided to Samantha and Jeff that he had mentioned the lawsuit to two of his closest trial lawyer buddies, two guys in different firms in West Virginia. Neither had an interest in spending the next 5 years brawling with Casper Slate, regardless of how egregious its behavior. A week later, Donovan flew to Charleston, West Virginia, to file the Hammer Valley contamination case. Outside the federal courthouse, facing a gang of reporters and with four other lawyers beside him, he laid out their case against Kroll Mining. Russian-owned, of course. He claimed the company had been polluting the groundwater for 15 years, that it knew what was happening and covered it up, and that Kroll Mining had known for at least the last 10 years that its chemicals were causing one of the highest rates of cancer in America. Donovan confidently said, "We'll prove it all, and we have the documents to back it up." He was lead counsel, and his group represented over 40 families in Hammer Valley. Like most trial lawyers, Donovan loved the attention. Samantha suspected he rushed the Hammer Valley filing because he was still in the spotlight from the Tate verdict. She tried to back away and ignore the Gray brothers for a few days, but they were persistent. Jeff wanted to have dinner. Donovan needed her advice, he said, because both of them represented Buddy Reiser. She was aware of his growing frustration with his trial lawyer friends, none of whom were showing any enthusiasm for tackling Casper Slate. Donovan said more than once he would go solo if necessary. "More of the fee for me," he said. He became obsessed with the case and talked to Marshall Kofer every day. To their surprise, Marshall came through with the money. A litigation fund was offering a line of cash of up to $2 million for 30% of the recovery. Donovan was again pressing Samantha to work in his office. The Hammer Valley case and the Reiser case would soon be all-consuming, and he needed help. She felt strongly that he needed an entire staff of associates, not just a part-time intern. When he verbally settled the Tate case for $1.7 million, he offered her a full-time position with a generous salary. She declined. Again. She reminded him that, A, she was still wary of litigation and not looking for a job. B, she was just passing through, sort of on loan until the dust settled up in New York and she could figure out the next phase of her life. A phase that would have nothing to do with Brady, Virginia. And C, she had made a commitment to the legal clinic and actually had real clients who needed her. What she didn't explain was that she was afraid of him and his cowboy style of lawyering. She was convinced that he, or someone working on his behalf, had stolen valuable documents from Kroll Mining, and that this would inevitably be exposed. He was not afraid to break rules and laws and wouldn't hesitate to violate court orders. He was driven by hatred and a burning desire for revenge, and at least in her opinion, was headed for serious trouble. She could hardly admit to herself that she felt vulnerable around him. An affair could flare without much effort, and that would be a dreadful mistake. What she needed was less time with Donovan Gray, not more. She wasn't sure how to handle Jeff. He was young, single, sexy, thus a rarity in those parts. He was also hot on her trail, and she knew that dinner, wherever one might find a nice dinner, would lead to something else. After 3 weeks in Brady, she rather liked that idea. On November 12th, Donovan, with no co-counsel in sight, marched into the federal courthouse in Lexington, Kentucky, home to an 800-member law firm officially known as Casper, Slate, and Hughes, and sued the bastards. He also sued Lone Rock Coal, a Nevada corporation. Buddy and Mavis were with him, and of course, he had alerted the press. They chatted with some reporters. One asked why the lawsuit had been filed in Lexington, and Donovan explained that he wanted to expose Casper Slate to its hometown folks. He was aiming for the scene of the crime, and so on. The press had a grand time with the story, and Donovan collected press clippings. 2 weeks earlier, he had filed the Hammer Valley lawsuit against Kroll Mining in Charleston and received regional coverage. 2 weeks before that, he had won the Tate case with a spectacular verdict and got his name in a few newspapers. On November 24th, 3 days before Thanksgiving, they found him dead. Chapter 23. The nightmare began in the middle of Monday morning, as all the lawyers were working quietly at their desks, not a client in sight. The silence was shattered when Maddie screamed, a painful, piercing cry that Samantha was certain she would remember forever. They raced to her office.
"He's dead," she wailed. "He's dead! Donovan's dead!"
She was standing with one hand on her forehead. The other hand held the phone in midair. Her mouth was open, her eyes filled with terror.
"What?"
Annette shrieked.
"They just found him. His plane crashed. He's dead."
Annette fell into a chair and began sobbing. Samantha stared into Maddie's eyes, both unable to speak for a second. Barb was in the door, both hands over her mouth. Samantha finally walked over and took the phone. "Who is it?" she asked.
"Jeff,"
Maddie said, as she slowly sat down and buried her face in her hands. Samantha spoke into the receiver, but the line was dead. Her knees were weak, and she backed into a chair. Barb collapsed into another one. A moment passed, a moment laden with fear, shock, and uncertainty. Could there be a mistake? No. Not if Donovan's only sibling called his beloved aunt to deliver the worst possible news. No, it was not a mistake, or a joke, or prank. It was the unbelievable truth. The phone was ringing again, all three incoming lines blinking as the word was spreading rapidly through the town. Maddie swallowed hard and managed to say,
"Jeff said Donovan flew to Charleston yesterday to meet with some lawyers. Jeff was out of town over the weekend and Donovan was by himself. Air traffic control lost contact with him around 11 last night. Somebody on the ground heard a noise, and they found his plane this morning in some woods a few miles south of Pikeville, Kentucky."
Her quivering voice finally gave out, and she lowered her head. Annette was mumbling,
"I can't believe this. I can't believe this."
Samantha was speechless. Barb was a blubbering mess. More time passed as they cried and tried to come to grips with what was happening. They calmed a bit as the first hint of reality settled in. After a while, Samantha left the room and locked the front door. She moved quietly around the offices, closing curtains and blinds. Darkness engulfed the clinic. They sat with Maddie as the phones rang and rang in the distance, and all the clocks seemed to stop. Chester, with his own key, entered through the rear door and joined the morning. He sat on the edge of the desk with one hand on his wife's shoulder and patted gently as she sobbed and whispered to herself. Softly, Chester asked,
"Have you talked to Judy?"
Maddie shook her head and said,
"No. Jeff said he would call her."
"Poor Jeff. Where is he?"
"He was in Pikeville, taking care of things, whatever that means. He was not doing too well."
A few minutes later, Chester said,
"Let's go home, Maddie. You need to lie down, and no one's working around here today."
Samantha closed her office door and fell into her chair. She was too stunned to think of anything else, so she stared at the window for a long time and tried to organize her thoughts. Organization failed her, and she was consumed with the sudden desire to flee Brady and Nolan County and all of Appalachia, and perhaps never come back. It was Thanksgiving week, and she was planning to leave anyway, to head for D.C. and spend time with her parents and maybe some friends. Maddie had invited her to Thanksgiving lunch, but she had already declined. Some Thanksgiving. They were now staring at a funeral.
Her cell phone vibrated. It was Jeff. At 4:30 that afternoon, he was sitting on a picnic table at a remote scenic overlook near Knox in Curry County. His truck was parked nearby, and he was alone, as expected. He did not turn to see if it was her, did not move as she walked across the gravel toward him. He was gazing into the distance, lost in a world of jumbled thoughts. She kissed him on the cheek and said, "I'm so sorry." "Me too," Jeff said, and managed a quick smile. A forced one that lasted only a second. He took her hand as she sat beside him. Knee to knee, they silently watched the ancient hills below them. There were no tears, and few words at first. Jeff was a tough guy, far too macho to be anything but stoic. She suspected he would do his crying alone. Deserted by his father, orphaned by his mother, and now left abandoned by the death of the only person he ever truly loved. Samantha could not imagine his anguish at this awful moment. She herself felt as though there was a gaping hole in her stomach, and she had known Donovan for less than 2 months. "You know they killed him," he said, finally putting into words what they had been wondering throughout the day. "And who are they?" she asked.
"Who are they?"
"They are the bad guys, and there are so many of them. They are ruthless and calculating, and for them, killing is no big deal. They kill miners with unsafe mines. They kill hillbillies with contaminated water. They kill little boys who are sound asleep in their trailer. They kill entire communities when their dams break and their slurry ponds flood the valleys. They killed my mother. Years ago, they killed union men who were striking for better wages. I doubt if my brother is the first lawyer they've killed." "Can you prove it?"
"I don't know, but we'll try. I was in Pikeville this morning. I had to identify the body, and I stopped by to see the sheriff. I told him I suspected foul play, and I wanted the airplane treated like a crime scene. I've already notified the feds. The plane did not burn up, just crashed. I don't think he suffered."
"Can you imagine having to identify the body of your brother?" Her shoulders slumped at the thought. She shook her head. He grunted and said, "They had him at the morgue. Just like you see on television. Open the vault, slide him out, slowly pull back the white sheet. I almost threw up. His skull was cracked."
"That's enough," she said.
"Yes, that's enough. I suppose there are certain things in life you're never prepared to do. And after you do them, you swear you'll never do them again."
"Do most people go through life without ever having to identify a body? Let's talk about something else."
"Okay. Good idea. What do you want to talk about?"
"How do you prove it was a criminal act?"
"We'll hire experts to examine the plane from prop to tail. The NTSB will review the radio transmissions to see what was going on right before the crash. We'll piece this thing together and figure it out."
A clear night, perfect weather, an experienced pilot with 3,000 hours in his logbook, one of the safest airplanes in history. It just doesn't make sense otherwise. He finally pissed off the wrong people, I guess. A breeze blew in from the east, scattering leaves and bringing a chill. They huddled closer together like old lovers, which they were not. Not old, not new, not current. They'd had dinner twice, nothing more. The last thing Samantha needed was a complicated romance with a definite expiration date.
She wasn't sure what he wanted. He spent a lot of time away from Brady, and she suspected there was a girl involved. They had absolutely no future together. The present might be fun, a romp here, a frolic there, a little companionship on cold nights, but she wasn't about to rush in. He said, "You know, I've always thought the worst day of my life was the day Aunt Maddie came to my classroom at school and told me my mother was dead. I was 9 years old. But this is worse. Much worse. I'm numb. So numb you could stick knives in me and I wouldn't feel anything. I wish I'd been with him." "No, you don't. One loss is enough. I cannot imagine life without Donovan. We were basically orphans, you know, raised by relatives in different towns. He was always looking out for me, always had my back. I got into a lot of trouble, and I wasn't afraid of my relatives or school teachers or the cops or even the judges. I was afraid of Donovan, and not in a physical sense. I was afraid of letting him down. The last time I went to court, I was 19 years old. He had just finished law school. They'd caught me with some pot, a small amount that I was actually trying to sell, but they didn't know it. The judge gave me a break. A few months in the county jail, but nothing serious. When I was about to walk up to the bench and face the judge, I turned around and looked at the courtroom. There was my brother, standing next to Aunt Maddie. And he had tears in his eyes. I'd never seen him cry. So I cried too, and I told the judge he would never see my face again. And he didn't. I've had one speeding ticket since then. His voice cracked slightly as he pinched his nose. Still, no tears, though. He was my brother, my best friend, my hero, boss, confidant. Donovan was my world. I don't know what I'll do now. Samantha felt like crying. "Just listen," she said to herself. "He needs to talk." "I'm going to find these guys, Samantha. Do you hear me? If it takes every dime I have and every dime I have to steal, I'll track them down and get revenge. Donovan wasn't afraid to die. Neither am I. I hope they're not." "Who's your number one suspect?" "Kroll Mining, I guess.